House Committee on Intergovernmental Affairs, March 6, 1989.
Call the House Committee on Intergovernmental Affairs to order, and we've rearranged the schedule a little bit, but we are going to get through to everything today. And I'd like to start off with and open the public hearing on 2729 and call forward Clifford Freeman, who has been here about three different times, prepared to share some information, and we haven't been able to get to him. Or actually, we dismissed him so he could get back to work. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. What I have prepared is some information regarding the size of the firms that the Department of General Services Purchasing Division has done business with, and put that information in a summary form. There should be two handouts in front of you, one titled 1988 Contracts with Businesses and Size of Business Summary, and the other 1988 Bids Awarded Businesses and Size of Business. To take the contracts first. Now, the contracts that we enter into include what are called price agreements, public works projects, and service contracts. Price agreements, by way of explanation, are agreements that we'll make with a vendor, and they'll have a duration of a year, and in the course of that year, state agencies will be required to purchase from that price agreement if they need that particular product. And then we also sell or we permit political subdivisions to purchase off that price agreement so they can get the benefit of the price that we get. For example, police cars. We have police cars on a price agreement. We have a dealer that sells the police cars, so the state of Oregon state police, they buy their police cars from this dealer, and then the political subdivisions, different cities and counties around the state will also buy them off price agreements. At any rate, calling your attention to the contract summary, the information in the upper half is the size of the business for the employees in Oregon. The bottom half of the page is the size of the business for the total company, if they're a national or international concern. That's included in the bottom half figures. The two data displays on the top represent a cutoff at 19 or fewer employees, and also 25 or fewer. I use 19 because 19 was the information that was used in 1986 by the Department of Economic Development when they collected the information about the size of the firms. Remember, that was they said 90.2% of the firms were 19 or fewer, 8.5 were 20 to 99, and 1.5 were over 100. So I used 19, and I used 25 because the 25 or fewer was the figure used in this piece of legislation. If we just look at the size of the business operations in Oregon, and we use a cutoff of 19, you can see that 56% of the 405 businesses that we have contracts with were 19 or fewer. If we go to 25 or fewer, 64% of those businesses were the small business category. And then if we look at the total employees in the business, if we use 19 as a cutoff, we have 49. If we use 25 as a cutoff, we have 57. Now, one of the reasons that I took the total employees in the business was because in some instances we have, we do businesses with large corporations that are permitted under our statutes to be considered as a resident Oregon business. They have employees in Oregon, they pay Oregon taxes, yet the business entity itself may be 10 or 20,000 or more. So to make sure that these figures weren't distorted, I represented the total size of the company in the data in the bottom half of the page.
Reverend, have you had a chance to share any of this with Representative McTeague?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I did leave a copy of both of these documents at Mr. McTeague's, Representative McTeague's office with this assistant, and I spoke with them not too long after I appeared here the last time, and I told them that I was going to get this information together, and so I did share the information with them and explained it.
It would appear that no matter how you look at it, we're doing a substantial amount of our business with small or medium-sized companies, right?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is true. We do, if we look at the contracts or if we look at the business that is awarded via bid, there's about half of the businesses that we do business with are small businesses, if you cut it off at 19 or fewer, or if you cut it off at 25.
So it would appear that it would take a lot of work to increase that through a statute type approach.
I would, yes, Mr. Chairman, I would think so, and I'm not sure that there. Let's put it this way. One of the things that is a fact in state procurement is reciprocal statutes, and we have a reciprocal statute in Oregon. One of the last handout that I had given you was a copy from our bid document that recites reciprocal law on it with the residency information. Down at the first half recites the legislation, the second half asks for information. If a vendor receives a benefit or a preference in their home state, then under our law, under reciprocal preference law, we will apply the same percentage that they get against their bid if they bid in Oregon. So if a small business was to get a preference by the Oregon legislature here in Oregon, 27 of the 50 states also have, 27 of the 50 states have reciprocal legislation. So that would be something that they would encounter in 26 of the states, because Oregon's counting 27. The nature of those reciprocal statutes vary from mirroring exactly what happens in the state of the resident bidder to when they come to a different jurisdiction, to situations like Pennsylvania, where if you're a vendor and you're doing business in Pennsylvania, if the goods are produced in a state where there's a preference given to businesses in that state, Pennsylvania won't accept your goods. So they're at one end of the scale on that. The other end of the scale would be a state where they limit it to 5%, and in no instance would they give more than a 5% reciprocal preference.
Okay, great. We appreciate you gathering this information. We'll touch base with Representative McTeague and make certain that he's had a chance to digest it.
Thank you.
Are there any questions of Clifford while he's here?
Thank you. Jack Nelson. If you don't take too long, we probably won't do anything with this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Jack Nelson, representing the Associated General Contractors. In the interest of time in your agenda, I submitted a letter dated the 24th, which outlines the concerns that we have over set-asides and preferences.
You'd be just as happy if we didn't do anything?
Given the specific the specifics of this particular approach, we would oppose it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any questions? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on 27-29 and go into work session on House Bill 3022. You want to tell us what we have in the way of amendments?
Mr. Chairman, if you'll recall, this was a bill that was introduced at the request of the Jackson County Board of Commissioners. The intent of the bill is to expand the current statutory authority that allows certain local governments, namely cities, to issue general obligation citizens' bonds. These citizens' bonds are that's the term generally used to define bonds that are denominated in amounts less than $5,000. The basic purpose of these kinds of bonds are to permit persons who do not have the financial resources to purchase bonds in $5,000 increments to have access to a debt instrument that gives them the benefits of being tax-free without having to expend large amounts of money. We do have an amendment to the bill that was based on the concern that was raised by the representative from the Port of Portland, basically that they also, in their particular statute, have the authority to issue citizens' bonds, and they are not now subject to the various kinds of oversight restrictions that this particular bill would place on them. They would be if the bill were passed as it was originally worded, which would extend the authority to issue citizens' bonds to any municipality, because they are included within the statutory definition of what a municipality is. So we've had amendments drafted that would, at every location in which the term municipality appears in the bill, that would be replaced with the term city or county, so that Jackson County and all other counties would have access to this statute, but any other jurisdiction, such as the Port of Portland, would not be affected by it.
Are there any questions? Okay, we're in work session.
Back row there. I guess not. Excuse me. Do you want a motion on this now?
Yes, why don't we?
I'll move.
Well, let me check. Is there anyone that wants to comment on House Bill 3022?
No one signed up.
Yeah, no one had signed up. Yes, why don't we move ahead?
Okay, I'll move. Chair, I'll move the amendments to House Bill 3022-1, also known as LC 3133, dated 3/20/89.
Okay, Representative Markham moves the amendments to House Bill 3022, the dash one, LC 3133, dated 20/89. Is there any objection, discussion? If not, we'll accept the amendments. Yes.
I'll move the floor, as Chairman, do pass as amended.
Okay. Representative Markham moves House Bill 3022 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Edward, you want to call the roll?
Representative Cease. Representative Hostica.
Aye.
Representative Oakley?
Aye.
Representative Stein?
Aye.
Representative Wehage?
Aye.
Representative Markham?
Yeah. Aye.
Representative Young?
Aye. Passes. Who would like to carry this?
I'll take it.
Okay, Representative Wehage will carry that. And we'll move on to work session on 3397. Yeah, why don't you go over it, John?
Mr. Chairman, if you you'll recall, this is a bill that was introduced at the request of Multnomah County and the City of Portland. It basically repeals an existing statutory requirement that an independent appraisal be performed on county-owned property acquired through foreclosure before that property can be sold at a sheriff's sale. The committee received testimony indicating that this independent appraisal process is a reasonably costly process that does not apparently contribute greatly to the process of disposing of this property in a timely or efficient manner. At this point in time, we have no proposed amendments to the bill.
Okay, is there any questions on this? Do you remember they went through and kind of outlined the where this would fit in the procedure on foreclosure, and there doesn't seem to be any opposition.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I'd say we've looked at this issue of foreclosure and sheriff sales a lot in the Revenue Committee relating to liens and all that, and this looks to be a reasonable thing from our point of view. I'd say, at least from my point of view, I don't know if President Cecil or Markham want to address that, but it looks like it's consistent with policies that we've adopted in the past.
Is it good enough for somebody to make a motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd move it. We are in work session.
Yes.
I move that we send House Bill 3397 to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Cease moves House Bill 3397 to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Not Edward, call the roll.
Representative Cease?
Aye.
Representative Hostica?
Aye.
Representative Oakley?
Aye.
Representative Stein?
Aye.
Representative Wehage?
Aye.
Representative Markham?
Aye.
Representative Young?
Aye. Passes. Who would like to carry this? How about Representative Markham?
That's fine.
Thank you. Okay, well.
You're larger than I am.
What's that?
You're larger than I am.
Oh, I see. Okay, we'll move into the work session on 3224, the Systems Development Charge Bill. And why don't we have them come up and explain the amendments? And
good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jim Irvin. On behalf of the Oregon State Home Builders Association, and with me today, I think Marge Kafori from the City of Portland will also join us, Charlie Hales from the Metropolitan Home Builders Association, and DJ Smith from the League of Oregon Cities. We are, our love fest is continuing. we are here to present some technical corrections, which have come from LC is 3224-1. And I think we'll allow BJ and Charlie to go through and respond to any of your questions, outline them, and then respond to any of your questions.
Mr.
on the
Chair.
Agenda.
Representative,
if the Love Fest is continuing, I don't understand why they all look so sick.
It's the other bills that are before this legislative assembly. Representative Cease. It's not this bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the
Representative Cease, I think part of the agreement was that nobody would look smug.
Oh, I see.
Intended
okay,
so that that the others would feel that something was being put over.
Mr. Chairman, I hope you'll pull us back in line if we do look smug at any point in time. I'm BJ Smith. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities. Let me clarify for you. You have a couple of pages of proposed amendments. Exactly what our wishes are. We would ask that the committee on 3224-1, that the committee take action to accept the recommendations we've made to you on lines 1 through 8, and we would like to withdraw the recommendation on line 9. That is because Legislative Council has indicated to me that the word account is used consistently through the statutes rather than the typical accounting term that would be used there.
So basically, delete line 9.
Delete line 9.
Page 17 of the amendment.
Line 9 of the the Dash 1 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, you also, I believe, have a set of amendments, House 3224-2. We have agreed to ask that you not consider those amendments. We would like those amendments withdrawn. We think that the bill is clear enough as it stands and would not like to clutter the language in the bill that's before you. And there is, I believe, a third set, 3224-3, that is simply the legislative instruction that would put this piece of new law in ORS 223, which is where financing for cities and counties for local improvement districts is listed. And we think that would be a convenient place to put it in the statutes. And we would hope that you would accept 3224-3.
And we are all here to answer any questions. No one is smiling.
So let's talk about the one you deleted, because that was the only provision. Where does that leave us in terms of a list of things that STCs can be used for, and when can it go beyond that?
Mr. Chairman,
or in what would be the process?
What was your question?
On the Dash 2 amendments would have inserted on page one, line 8, would have, after used, it would have inserted only for the following, and then it lists the types of improvements that it could be used for.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Jim Irvin for the Home Builders again. If you look at the list in Section 2, that is a finite list, and using the word only is just further overkill. Again, we have spent a great deal of time with council, both legislative council and our own respective councils, trying to pick language so that everybody understands it, and we just didn't want to clutter the statutes any further.
Okay, so just to clarify, if somebody wanted to do a systems development charge in some fashion for capital construction of schools, for instance, or for library or library services, that would require the legislature.
The will of the legislature, yes.
Mr. Chairman, I think that the statutory authority there is clear, and we've had 2 days of discussion trying to make certain that if you're not on the list using this statute, you neither have authority or restrictions granted by the legislature if it isn't on the list. Yeah.
The presumption, of course, is that Charlie Hale with the Home Builders, that this is not an including but not limited to list. That is a school systems development charge would be facilities or assets used for something other than those on the list, therefore contrary to the act.
Okay. Representative Markham.
Jim, was anything pulled off the list, or any particular pressure group came in and said we want this or that?
I guess I can address that. Charlie Hales again, Representative Markham. That list is a reflection of what systems development charges are used for now in the state of Oregon. It is neither an expansion into new areas. There is at least one jurisdiction with each one of these somewhere in the state, and nor does it include any that have not yet been used. So this is the state of the art.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Representative Wehade.
I appreciate all the work that's been done on this. And Amendment 1, this, I think the first part of this is in direct response to the question I asked during the last meeting on this. I want to focus in on a couple of words here, BJ. The phrase increased usage. As I understand it, the intent is to allow for, especially for sewage treatment works where there's increased flow. I'm concerned that it's possible to interpret that as without changing flow, you might increase the efficiency of the operation, such as adding a tertiary plant to an existing secondary treatment facility. How is that excluded, and if it is, how is it excluded from this type of wording?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wehage, what we tried to do in response to the concerns raised before, which I think this is pretty much the tertiary treatment concern, we had a discussion of what capacity is in another place in the bill, and we tried to put a time certain for when the SDC would be levied. I think you would look at the word usage and use it in its conventional context, the use of the system. And an example, it's somewhat difficult to imagine when you'd have increased usage that would not occur at the same time as the issuance of a development permit or a building permit. But one example might be the restoration of a large Victorian home into a bed and breakfast, where you really have gone from a residential dwelling and there's a certain assumed rate of usage in that residential dwelling and gone to a commercial enterprise, which the usage assumptions might be different. So I think you would look to the conventional use of that word and look at usage as the parameter.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-on question. I guess what I'm, again, I'm looking at in Section 5, where it talks about reimbursement fees and improvement fees. If I understand this correctly, basically, we're taking system development charges and talking about them in terms of either they're either reimbursement fees or improvement fees or a combination of the two. And under improvement fees, it talks about in the second sentence, an increase in system capacity may be established if a capital improvement increases the level of performance or service. And that's the phrase I zeroed in on, level of performance as far-reaching meanings. It's more than just a capacity increase. Performance could be increasing the quality of the water as it comes out of the treatment plant. That's increasing the level of performance in my mind. And that's where my concern was.
Okay. Representative Wehage, that you would have to have, you would both have to meet the requirement on Section 5, Sub 2, and the fee would be assessed at the point in time of increased usage or the development permit or building permit. And I think that's how we try to get the fence around the issue that you've been describing. I do not believe that just an upgrading of a sewage treatment plant to tertiary, absent increased usage by the particular user, a building permit or a development permit would allow you to introduce a systems development fee or charge a systems development fee under this act.
Let me just ask the home builders if that's their understanding also on this.
Let me respond to that. Charlie Hales again. We've all gone through a lot of examples, and BJ's always using sewer examples, and I'm always using road
that's
examples,
fine.
So bear with
I'm
me. Remember, Representative Wehage, that Section 5 is governing what they can be expended on, not what they may be charged to. Okay. Mm-hmm. The best example that I've been able to use or keep in my mind about increase in service is an intersection that has a four-way stop sign on it and allows 250 cars a day to cross. The installation of a stoplight would take that to 1,000 cars a day. Without paving any more street, we have significantly increased the level of service by installing that capital improvement, the stoplight. Well, if that example is any more useful to you than the others, but that's my favorite one anyway.
You see that as a valid use?
That is a valid use. That not simply paving more roadway, but making the roadway that we have work to carry more traffic is an increase in level service and is an appropriate use of systems development charge monies.
Mr. Chairman, I'm satisfied.
Okay. As a practical matter, probably 90% of the time when a subdivision goes in, there's discussions about what types of impacts are going to be and what may be needed before the subdivision is totally built out in terms of maybe street improvements or sewer improvements and that type of thing. So it's kind of a partnership in that respect anyway, isn't it? And it's
yes.
Only when there isn't that kind of discussion that there's a real problem.
Yes, though thanks to I think some fairly sophisticated development codes in most jurisdictions now, Mr. Chairman, and thanks to the requirement in this bill that you credit the developer for installing part of the system
right.
off-site as a condition of approval, mm-hmm. I think we've established a good framework so that that's more certain and less of an open-ended negotiation than it might have been in the past.
Right. BJ, what would you say with the cities around the state. That, and I know that they've looked at this pretty close, having followed the league's newsletter. Would you say that most of the cities are fairly comfortable with this at this point?
Mr. Chairman, that's a tough question, but I think that's a true statement. I think most cities recognize that this will require some fine-tuning and readjustment of what they've been doing in the past to make certain that everything is taken care of structurally and systematically that we have in the bill. But in particular, most of our larger cities that have large amounts of systems development charges, the foundation is not unlike what we're talking about in the bill. We are hoping not to revolutionize systems development charges, but to put into state statute what we believe is good practice that exists in most cities already.
And I won't ask Jim if most home builders are satisfied, because I know some would just soon not have any systems development charges.
As you heard the other day, Mr. Chairman.
We helped them out in revenue this morning.
Oh, good. Well, you do something here and take something away there. We're in work session. If anybody would like to move the